You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Oh, and I think winter has returned.
Well, it is still February.
Yeah, and it's such a shock to walk out this morning and feel that cold air. You know?
I know. We thought we were living in San Diego for the past few days. Yeah. And, I guess... I want to say Iowa seems to be the winner in the climate change.
Well, we have certainly dodged the bullet with many, many storms this winter.
Yeah.
Neither went north or south of us. And so we might get something this weekend. We'll see.
We'll see. Well, what do we have
Oh, we have something
today.
Really interesting today.
What do we have in store today?
We have a great story and a book in store, and I'm hoping that everybody will get a chance to look at it or to read it, to buy it and look at it. The pictures are amazing, and it's about the hula. Now, I know we have all grown up thinking the hula was the grass skirts and that was it, but there's much, much more to it. I mean, it's okay. Constance Hale, or better known as Connie Hale, is a Hawaii-born, San Francisco-based journalist who has been writing about Hawaiian culture for more than 25 years. Her award-winning features on slack key guitar, sovereignty movement, the Hawaiian language, Big Island cowboys, and spam sushi have appeared in The Atlantic, National Geographic, Adventure, Afar, Smithsonian, Los Angeles Times, Miami Herald, and Honolulu. She has also worked as a staff reporter and editor at the Oakland Tribune and San Francisco Examiner. Oh, my goodness. She started dancing the hula at 7 years old and performed in her school, of course. And then she switched to ballet and jazz. And she holds a bachelor's degree in Princeton and a master's degree at from UC Berkeley. And she has studied with Patrick Kumu Patrick, as he is known, because that's who this book is basically about, his teaching of hula. And I mean, I just couldn't believe how it has grown and flourished and expanded.
And the title of the book is "The Natives Are Restless: A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century" by Constance Hale. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Connie.
It's so great to be with both of you. Thank you, Monica and Caroline.
So you've been a writer for quite a long time.
Yes. I started, I really started in college, and I was, like many writers, I started with poetry and short stories and had ideas of being this great novelist. And very slowly, my work ended up going more to nonfiction. And I've done a lot of travel writing. Got into travel writing sort of by accident because I just wanted to write about Hawaii, where I was born and where I was brought up and where I've always been fascinated by the culture. And been exploring, I would say, the edges of journalism in a way. You know, how can I write stories about whatever subject I choose in a way that has a lot of the elements of poetry and fiction, but is about our world.
So you're a native of Hawaii in the sense that you were born there. Are you considered an Hawaiian native?
No, I'm not Native Hawaiian is the word that I use to refer to people who are of Polynesian heritage, so the indigenous people of Hawaii. And I'm not. I'm Caucasian, or as you say in Hawaii, haole. I grew up out in the country, though, in a community that was very Hawaiian. So I had a lot of, I was really immersed in Hawaiian culture in a way, even though my family was itself originally from the U.S. mainland.
You know, I'm curious, too, about how you've written three books on language and literary style, including Sin and Syntax. So I'm curious what that is exactly, and also an 8-part series on writing a sentence in the New York Times.
So, yeah, my language books, it's sort of funny. I have this sideline as a grammarian or a language maven or whatever you want to call it. Basically, the story of those books is kind of interesting, and it relates to this book tangentially in that it has everything to do with the fact that I grew up in Hawaii. So if you can imagine, I was born in a little sugar plantation town out on the north shore of Oahu. That's as far away from Honolulu as you can get. It was pretty, it was country, as we call it still. And my parents were from the U.S. mainland, as I mentioned. They had both been well-educated and gone to colleges on the East Coast, but they loved Hawaii. We, meanwhile, grew up in this little sugar plantation town, and where we lived, everyone spoke what we called Pidgin English, which is actually a Creole. It's called Hawaiian Creole by linguists. So I had this weird growing up experience. I say that it's like the reverse immigrant experience. We spoke non-standard English with our friends and at school and everywhere in society, and then we spoke standard English at the dinner table. And my parents insisted on proper grammar and were pretty strict about it. So I grew up with these sort of bilingual in English, with two different Englishes going on in my head. And as I started to study English literature, and this actually, the kind of key moment was at Princeton, when I was very frustrated. We were studying poetry, and I remember we were studying T.S. Eliot and The Wasteland, and I told my professor, who was a very famous Princeton professor, I said, I'm so frustrated, because whenever we talk about poetry, we don't talk about the sound and the rhythm and all the elements of the words that are musical and make poetry different from prose. We're just talking about images and allusions and metaphors, which doesn't seem to get to the heart of poetry. And he said, you know, that's so interesting. I found it very hard to talk with my students about those elements of language. And he said, he pulled out one poem, I think it was Keats or something, and we talked about the sound of the poem. And he said, well, you seem to have a good ear for this, a good ear for language. And I said, I think that's because I grew up speaking two Englishes. I grew up speaking Pidgin English. And he looked at me and he said, Pidgin what? And he was kind of surprised. And I said, well, it's this language that we speak at home. And he said, well, can you give me an example? So I told him the story of Little Red Riding Hood, or actually it's Little Red Riding Hood and Pidgin, which is Little Lei Puahi and the Wild Pua'a. It features a big, hairy boar with tusks, because we don't have a wolf. Gaudy and very funny. And he loved it. And I had this aha moment right then and there that I had grown up sort of always being proud that I could speak Pidgin, because it kind of established my bona fides as a local, you know, local person. It really meant that I was from that place, but I was also at a place like Princeton. I was kind of embarrassed that that's where I came from and that's how we spoke, because it seemed so
uneducated
to stigmatize it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
From that moment forward, I sort of developed my own attitude towards language. I realized that it was really wonderful that I grew up speaking Pidgin, and I thought, you know, Black English is really wonderful, Spanglish is really wonderful. I had a very different attitude towards non-standard Englishes and Creoles in particular. And so moving forward both as a writer and as a teacher, I tried to develop a new attitude towards grammar in English, and it's really encoded in the title of my book, Sin and Syntax. Yes, as writers and as intelligent people and as people who want to be able to express themselves beautifully, we need to know the underlying rules of English, sort of the way English works. And if you're a writer, that's really, that's what you're supposed to know. That's what you're supposed to study. And yet oftentimes, the most brilliant writing breaks the rules. Mm. And so all of my books kind of explore both English grammar and the rules as they've been passed down since the 1700s, which is when grammar was invented, basically, wholesale.
I've been told
those
that.
Rules and the language that we actually speak and the language that we want to use when we write. So that's it's just an area of fascination with me, and I've happened to write three books may or another relate to that question.
I've been told that English is a really difficult language to master. From someone who's from another country. Is that true, do you think?
Yeah, I've heard that too. I mean, one thing about English is that that makes it different from other languages is that it has absorbed so many other languages. So we had Anglo-Saxon originally, and then the Normans invaded England, and so we absorbed a lot of French words, and we absorbed a lot of Latin words. I mean, different times we absorbed Latin words. And English has gone, because of the British Empire, you know, we have words in English that come from India, from Hindi, and we have a lot of words in our, like, moccasin and canoe that come from Native American languages. So it's a language with a vast, vast number of words, many more words than other comparable languages. Even though it's a relatively young language, we have so many more words. And then, I don't know, I don't think the rules of grammar are any harder in English than they are in other languages, but I think that just the vast vocabulary makes it different. And the fact that our language, our words aren't pronounced the way they look on the page, that makes it hard to learn.
Yeah, and also, aren't there a lot of exceptions to the grammatical rules in English?
Well, so now we're going to get really we're going to get grammar geeky here. So the thing that happened in England in English is that we had this language. Our original language was Anglo-Saxon. So already Anglo-Saxon tells you it's already a meld of two different languages. It's a meld of the language that was in the English islands, and then it was German. So there's the Angles and the Saxons came and invaded England and pushed the Celts out. And so we had an early language, and there was some Celtic in it. And then English became this meld of Germanic languages. And it evolved over years, and as I said, you know, the Scandinavians came down. We have a lot of words like freckle is a Scandinavian origin, and cake is Scandinavian origin. So words that seem very English, you know, very, very much part of our language, are actually of Scandinavian origin. So we had this melting pot language, and we didn't actually have a grammar, and the grammar was changing. The grammar rules were changing as these other languages came in, and then there were, I guess, some clerks and priests in the 1600s and 1700s who were perturbed that French had a grammar and Spanish had a grammar and all these other languages had a grammar and English didn't have a grammar. So they went and they grabbed Latin grammar, and they overlaid it onto English. And the problem was that English is not really a Latin language. It's a Germanic language. So one thing that happened in English is that we got some grammar rules that actually pertain more to Latin than they do. And so that's why the simplest one to explain is the idea of a split infinitive, that it was decided that you shouldn't split an infinitive, which means if you have to go, which is an infinitive form, you should never put an adverb in there between the to and the go. So you should never say to boldly go. And why do you not do that? Well, because in Latin languages, you can't split an infinitive because the infinitive is one word. So there's no way to split it. So that was a rule that was laid down and educated people for two centuries that you shouldn't split infinitives. There's absolutely no reason not to. I understand what to boldly go means. You understand what to boldly go.
Well, everybody who ever watched Star Trek understands
what it means. Everybody who ever watched Star Trek understands what it means. And so there are a lot of rules like that that are vestiges of Latin and vestiges of a time when they just took Latin grammar and applied it to English, but it doesn't. The rules don't really apply to English. So that's kind of, I think that's one reason why it's hard to learn English grammar. Sometimes it doesn't seem right, or it doesn't seem to explain things accurately.
So in your book, Sin and Syntax, do you describe these things? Do you go into detail on this?
I do. Well, Sin and Syntax is kind of a basic primer on the language. So I go through the eight parts of speech as we know them and the parts of a sentence. And then the last section of Sin and Syntax goes into some of the more musical elements of writing, so it doesn't have to do with grammar at all. Mm. My book, my third book, though, which is called Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, is really a history of the checkered history of the English verb. And in that book, I go a lot more into this kind of evolution of English, and I tell a lot more of the history of English and some of these, try to explain.
Now, what's the word for the study of an origin of a word? It begins with an E.
Well, etymology.
Etymology,
is that what you mean?
Yes, yeah. So are you an etymologist?
I wish I could say, yes, I'm an etymologist, but no, I'm just a writer. I'm just a writer with an oversized interest in these things. I look up the etymology of words very frequently, mostly because I use a dictionary a lot, and a good dictionary will tell you where a word comes from, and I'm fascinated. I speak French and I speak Spanish, and I'm kind of interested in Italian. I mean, I don't really speak it. I am really interested in where words come from, and I think as a writer, you have to be interested not just in the meaning of a word or the denotation of a word, the way it would be correctly defined in a dictionary, but you're interested in the shades of the word, not just the hue, but like all the shades and the associations of a word. So etymology becomes more important because you're interested in the root of a word and other words that a word might suggest. Let me give you an example. I hate the word predicate. Unfortunately, when we talk about English grammar, we talk about subjects and predicate. And what's a predicate? It's such a Latinate, ugly word. But when you think about the sentence and you think about, you know, every sentence in English and actually in every other language, the basic requirements of a sentence are that you have a subject and a predicate. You have something or someone, and then something happening. And when I thought about that word predicate, and I thought about how hard it is for us to kind of wrap our minds around that word, I looked at the root and I thought about the word predicament. I thought, oh, that's kind of cool, predicate, predicament. The predicate expresses the predicament of the sentence. Instead of subject and predicate, we could think of a sentence as having a protagonist.
And a predicament.
And so by looking at the root of a word, new meanings or new things become revealed to you. And sometimes when you're writing a sentence and you're trying to come up with the right noun or the right adjective, and sometimes not just, there are many choices that you have. So understanding these kind of underlying traces of other words or associations can be very helpful and useful when you're writing and you're trying to pick just the right word.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Connie Hale, author of The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century, which is a beautiful book. So, you know, Connie, you mentioned that talking about poetry, that the kind of the rhythm and the musicality of the words. Our guest last week on Writers' Voices was Ellen Hopkins, who writes novels in verse. And the only difference really between that type of poetry and prose is the musicality of the language.
Yes, although I would say, well, yeah, if she's writing novels and prose, then yes, she's got characters and she's got scenes and because they're novels.
Yeah,
so absolutely. I mean, some of the things that we associate with prose, you know, having to do, I mean, there's some structural things that are different between poetry and prose.
Yeah.
Certainly there's so much, I'm so happy that I started out when I was, my writing life as a poet, and was writing in a genre where I came to appreciate so deeply all the possibilities of words, because then I think it really animates your prose quite a bit. And, in this book, you know, I was trying to get on the page the feeling of dance on the stage. And so, you know, there's a lot of thought that goes into kind of language that you're going to use in each chapter. If I was describing a certain, you know, one dance, I might use different language than I might when I was describing another kind of dance. And so it's really wonderful, I think, to realize that you can love poetry and love the explorations that poetry allows you, and you can take all of that and use it in prose.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we want to get into a little more detail on your book, but first I wanted to ask you, as you know, growing up on Oahu, did you know of an artist, Mary Kosky?
No, I didn't.
Okay. She was fairly well known in Hawaii. She does pictures of children, portraits of children. And she was
beautiful
portraits. And they did calendars of her Hawaiian children and
what,
books
how is
of
their,
them.
Her last name spelled?
Kosky.
I'll have to look for her.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to ask me, did I know Barack Obama?
No. Just,
didn't know him personally, but he was 4 years behind me in high school.
Seriously?
So we had all the same teachers.
Oh, that's so cool.
We know people in common.
So, The Natives Are Restless. What made you decide to write this book?
You know, I had wanted to write a book about Hawaiian culture for a long time. So I In addition to writing my books on language, I write a lot of magazine articles, and I tend to focus, I write a lot of profiles, but I've written a lot about Hawaiian culture, about hula, about Hawaiian history, written about the Hawaiian language, which is a fascinating story of a language that almost died and then magically was revived in the last generation. I mean, the language was almost extinct, and it managed to be brought back. And I love the stories about Hawaii so much. There's some fascinating characters, wondered this sort of tragic history of Hawaii. And I was trying to find a subject for a book, and I thought of this one. I was reporting a story on land, on water use on Kauai, and I found a 80-year-old Hawaiian taro farmer who was in a legal battle with Pierce Brosnan, 007, over who would get the water from a stream, whether it would be for his pond or for her taro plants. And I thought, oh, is this a book? And, you know, I was just tossing about. I found always find a lot of magazine stories, but I really wanted to write something book-length. And coincidentally, my hula teacher, with whom I've been studying for 20 years in San Francisco. He's native Hawaiian. He grew up in the same era that I did in Honolulu, and then he moved to San Francisco and he started a hula school in San Francisco. I started studying with him 20 years ago, and because I'm a writer and an editor, I edit the newsletter of our hula school. And at one point I said to him, you know, I've been editing this newsletter for 15 years, and maybe I'm just kind of getting tired of it. Maybe we could rethink this. And we started a series of conversations, and he said, I think I said something like, we could write a book. I just sort of threw that out. And he heard that, and he latched on that, and he said, I think you should write a book. And I thought, wow, this is incredible. Here I have been looking for a book idea, something that would make a whole book, and it's been right in front of me for 20 years. And the arts organization, the Hula School is actually a large arts organization, would fund the book, the expenses of the book, and then he had this amazing collection of photographs of his work over the course of 20 years. Now, I actually met him 20 years ago because I was writing a story about him. I met him originally as a journalist, and so at the same time as I've been his student for 20 years, I've been watching him as a journalist and writing about him on occasion. And I thought, embodied in him was the story that I wanted to tell in a book, which is the story of the history of Hawaii, and the story of hula is the story of the history of Hawaii. It's a fascinating story that most people don't know. It's a tragic story. It's a mythological story. It's got everything. It's got history. It's got myth. It's got art. It's got characters. And yet the story of hula is also a story of a culture that was suppressed when missionaries came to Hawaii in the 19th century. They suppressed the hula. They hated the hula. They thought it was lascivious. I think one missionary said hula is the devil's nest. And so hula was really suppressed. And then in the late 1800s, one of the kings revived it because he saw it as part of his national identity. And the hula was revived. But then Hawaii was made a territory of the United States. And then hula was submerged again, and this whole cliche about Hawaii and a cliche about hula started to emerge in the 20th century that had a lot to do with politics and efforts to bring Hawaii into the fold, in a way, into the United States. And so hula had really suffered over a century and a half. And then at the same time as the language was being revived, starting about 30, 40 years ago, there was this effort by Native Hawaiians to reclaim their culture, and it has come back. I mean, hula is incredibly robust. There are hula schools. There's so many hula schools in Hawaii, in Japan, all over the United States mainland, and my own kumu was part of this story. I mean, he was part of that renaissance in Hawaii in the 70s and 80s when he started dancing hula. He came to San Francisco. He has one of the largest hula schools in the world here in San Francisco. And he, partly because he's been in San Francisco, he's been able to innovate and push the boundaries a little more than some hula teachers probably in Hawaii might be able to. And I realized that was the story that I wanted to tell about a resurgent culture, about a culture that had gone through so much tragedy and suppression and overcome so many obstacles, almost died. Any aspect of the culture that you look at, whether language, canoeing, hula, storytelling, those, they had all been under siege, and they've all come back. And they've come back with a vengeance, partly because of figures like Kumu Patrick. He's not the only one who's been a pioneer. There's sort of a cohort of his, all about the same age, who've said, you know, Hawaii is ours. Hawaiian culture is ours. And we don't want it to be like, we don't want the Hawaiian language to be like Latin, which is frozen in time or dead. We don't want hula to be fossilized. We want hula to be a living, growing thing that continues to evolve. And so that... I was going to say in a nutshell. That's a very big coconut shell, I would say, is in a nutshell. But that was the idea behind the book. I got very excited, and I thought, this is the story that I've wanted to tell, and I actually have a person through whom I can tell the story right here in front of me.
Mm. Go ahead.
And where did the title come from, The Natives Are
Good
Restless?
Good question. The title is, it's a little... cheeky, a little subversive. So, in 1996, Kumu Patrick, my hula teacher, was experimenting with hula, and his big experimentation was to take non-Hawaiian music that spoke to him in some way. That he's kind of a he used to be a DJ, and he really loves music, and he loves all kinds of music. And he thought, what if I pair hula motions and Hawaiian stories with non-Hawaiian music? So he started to do that, you know, really in the mid-90s, experimentally, and he loved the way that it worked. And he ended up getting a grant to do this very long piece called Salva Mea. So he told sort of the history of the conflict between missionaries and Native Hawaiians through a hula piece, and he used electronic music by a British band named Faithless. And it was a very strong piece, made a lot of waves. It was very controversial when it first came out. It's very dramatic, very violent, sometimes very dark, and very, very moving. And so that piece was quite successful. So then he decided to do a whole show in which he told the story of Hawaii, the Hawaiian historical story, in using some Hawaiian music and some non-Hawaiian music. And he titled that show, The Natives Are Restless. And that was kind of the theme of the show. And he, I would say, is a restless native. You know, he wants to take his culture and take it into new places. That show was very controversial at first. Now it's practically part of the hula canon. And 20 years later, he thought about that particular show, and he said he wanted to add a second act. So the original show was a one-act hula piece, in a way. It had several different numbers in one act. And he wanted to add a second act and bring hula up to date, bring this story into the 21st century. And so he decided that in October 2016, last fall, he would add a second act and debut a new version of this show. And when I heard that he was doing it, that was kind of the last thing to fall in place for the book, because I thought, perfect, that show expresses what I want to express in the book. And so it seemed like the appropriate name for the book, and then the book came out at the same time as the show debuted in San Francisco. So that's the genesis of the title. It's pegged to one of his most groundbreaking, significant works.
Well, I see that there are over 500 hula schools in the United States.
Yes.
That
Can you
is,
believe it?
That's wonderful.
Some of them are very small. You know, some of them might be... someone who's from Hawaii and just starts a hula class at a gym in New Jersey.
Sure,
some of them
sure.
are quite large, especially on the West Coast. Some of them, there's an ethnomusicologist at Michigan. She's Native Hawaiian. Her name is Amy Stillman. She's written very many important books about hula, and she's a kumu hula, and she has a hula school in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Wow. Well, I was fascinated by the pictures in the book, especially with the numbers of men, because we you know, we always think of hula as women dancing, and yet, I mean, it started in I'm sure it started with men back in the dawn of time when it started.
Sure. I mean, we don't really know because we don't have exact history books, and there are different myths about the beginning of hula, some featuring men, some featuring women. But, yeah, one of the subtexts or one of my goals in the book was to really change people's idea about hula. And hula, there are so many stereotypes that people hold about hula. And
right.
One of the stereotypes is that it's done by women. One of the stereotypes is that it's, you know, sort of lovely women in grass skirts with flower lace.
That's right.
Doing beautiful, you know, languid motions. And there's a lot of hula that is not like that at all. It's fierce. It's powerful. It's almost scary.
I can see that.
And so yeah. The photos, I think, are so important.
They are.
The idea was when you open the book, you sort of, every page you turn, you get a different snapshot of what hula is.
Mm-hmm.
And, wow, it's men. It's men in contemporary dress. It's men in ancient dress. It's women in this, and it's men and women. Wow, these people are dressed in Indian costume. You know, so we really wanted to convey through the images the multiplicity of images of.
Well, what makes a certain dance hula?
You know, it's mostly, first of all, it's the story. So the most important thing about hula, and so a lot of people think it's just motions, but the song or the mele is the word for song or the chant is the most important thing to understand about hula. So there's always a story being told. That's the most important thing. And that story is a Hawaiian story in some way or another. It's about Hawaiian gods or Hawaiian chiefs or a queen or there's a wonderful hula kaulana. There's a hula that praises the famous fireman of Honolulu. There's a hula that talks about riding a streetcar in Honolulu. So some of the stories are modern stories, but they are about Hawaii and the Hawaiian experience. And so that's the first thing, is the story being told. And then the motions, you know, there's a movement vocabulary. And so even when you're dancing to a non-Hawaiian song, you're still using the traditional Hawaiian movement vocabulary. And that's important. And then there are certain rituals and attitudes that the dancers embody that are very important. So I'd say those are the key elements to hula.
Well, they're all barefooted for one thing.
Yeah, we absolutely dance barefoot. It's kind of like yoga. You can't do hula even in socks. You know, you need to feel the ground.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's important because their energy comes from the ground,
mm-hmm.
and always did. And of course, you know, the volcanoes and all the other things about Hawaii that I don't know. I can see how it
there,
all blends.
And also, very many hulas describe places. I mean, place is so important in Hawaiian culture, and many of the hulas that we dance are praising a particular place. So the connection to the ground, to the earth, to the place is very important in hula, and we almost always dance in a deep knee bend. I mean, there's sometimes you lift up and your legs straighten out and your arms lift up. But it is a very grounded dance that is connected to the earth and your through your knees and your hips. People always think hula is all about the hands. It's actually the feet, the knees, the hips. That's where your grounding is.
That's really interesting. Now you talk about a movement vocabulary. Is it true that certain motions always convey certain meaning in the story?
Yes. There are certain, let's see, the most simple one, for example, is you have a certain motion for a flower. Pua is the Hawaiian word for flower. And so there's a certain motion that we use for that word. So there are some motions that are quite specific. Then there are motions, but many motions have multiple meanings. So just as one word might have multiple meanings, you might use the same motion for a mountain, a chief. You know, there are certain motions that have many meanings. So you can't you couldn't just sort of learn a hula by learning a set of motions and then putting them, stringing them together. A lot more fluid than that.
Well, there was quite a bit of reference to the song, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. And I was fascinated by that because I thought, that's a really slow song. And I'll bet that I would love to see that hula that went with that.
It's one of Kumu Patrick's most famous and most beloved hulas, and it's an example of this new hula style that he has pioneered, because here you have a completely non-traditional song, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face by Roberta Flack, and you're dancing hula to that song, but mm-hmm. all of the motions dancing are traditional Hawaiian hula motions. The dancers, there are several pictures of this in the book, the dancers are wearing, it's women dancers, and they're wearing elegant, beautiful black velvet gowns, and their hair's pulled back, almost like a ballerina's, into a chignon or a ballerina style, and maybe there's a big white lily, so it's very elegant, and it's slow, as you mentioned, the pace is slow, and it demands a lot of control on the part of the dancer. And there's something, it's hard to put into words, there's something very moving, very unexpected, very beautiful about that particular hula, which is one of the favorites of this halau. And Roberta Flack, once the hula dancers danced with Roberta Flack in a concert, and she said she couldn't watch it. It made her cry.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, Connie, why don't you read a little bit from the opening of your book so we get an idea of the feel of the book?
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm going to read from the preface. Most of the book is written in the third person, and most of it is about Kumu Patrick Makuakane. I'm going to read from the preface, which is in the first person, and talks a little bit about my experience of hula, and then ends up on Kumu Patrick. I am not the kind of person who talks to dead people. I don't testify. I leave spirits alone. And I tend to be skeptical of those who speak in tongues. Yet every Wednesday evening, I throw on a t-shirt and a gathered cotton skirt, rush to an elementary school cafeteria in San Francisco, and proceed to whirl my arms, stamp my feet, and call out to figures like Pele, the goddess of the volcano, Keakua Ikana Helehele, the god hidden in the mists of the low-hanging blood-red rainbow, and King Kalakaua, the merry monarch of the 19th century. I do this in a guttural voice that would horrify a charm school teacher and in a language that almost perished 100 years ago. Around me are dozens of other urbanites doing the same thing, my hula brothers and sisters. Some are native Hawaiian. Some are Samoan. Some are Korean, Filipino, Japanese, and Chinese. Some are Mexican, some Caucasian. Many are a mix of two or more of these. They may be 18 years old, or they may be 80, but most are ordinary mortals like me, 50-something, more lumpy than lithe, and definitely not fitting the stereotype of what a hula dancer is supposed to look like. We are the junior class of San Francisco's largest hula school, which also happens to be one of the largest hula schools in the world. Many of us have been dancing here for years. We started by learning the basic steps of the ancient, which include the graceful kaholo, the movement most people associate with hula. That's when we move from side to side, letting our hips flow in patterns as smooth as shore waves. We added, eventually, the awkward uehe, those hips moving, keep moving, while our knees take us into a plie and then suddenly pop out to each side, shaping our legs into hollow diamonds. Then we tackled 8 other odd-seeming steps. Eventually, we graduated to a few classic dances, 2 honoring that king, Kalakaua, and a 3rd reminiscing about a composer's childhood home on Maui. Soon we progressed to sassy numbers, heralding everything from the dainty cheeks of a beloved to the suggestive swaying of a boat. There's often more to the lyrics than the innocuous titles imply. In Noho Pai Pai, for example, the rocking chair of the title is hardly a soothing instrument of maternal love. Instead, the coy dancer invites a watching newcomer to touch noses and share a breath, a traditional Hawaiian greeting, and then join her on a wild ride on the rocking chair. We learn that we must master athletic moves and signal to our audience the meanings hidden in the metaphors. Through a mischievous smile, an especially deep hip undulation, or a provocative wink. Whatever their tone and range, all of these dances have the same profound relationship to Hawaiian culture and history. Quote, "Hula is the language of the heart, and therefore the heartbeat of the Hawaiian people," end quote, Kalākaua said in the mid-1800s. For centuries before him, hula was the history book, children's literature, and sacred text of a people with no written language. It maintained the relationship between gods and mortals. It preserved the greatness of the chiefly lines. It honored the race and encouraged procreation, and it traced the subtleties of the natural world, whether the rolling of waves on shore, the tumbling of waterfalls, or the distinctions between tropical mists, showers, and rains. But King Kalākaua couldn't have guessed that hula's domain would widen so dramatically. Not only would it become essential in preserving a culture battered by European and American influences, it would also claim pride of place in the 21st century alongside hip-hop, Cajun, tango, and other popular forms of dance. Nor could Kalākaua have known that one hula master would reinvent the dance form in a way that would retain some of the most sacred and sensual moves his teachers taught him, but also throw in a little Hollywood, a bit of Broadway, or a subversive dose of the San Francisco club scene. In doing so, he would not just rock the stages of San Francisco, New York, New Orleans, and Honolulu, but also prod, disturb, reinforce, and upend notions of what hula is, has been, and ever will be. That master is my own teacher, Kumu Patrick Makuakane.
Now, do you perform in
well,
in these?
I do. I'm actually, so the way a traditional school of hula is called a halau. That's the Hawaiian word for a school of hula. And so our halau is, as I mentioned in the excerpt, one of the largest in the country. It's about 350 people altogether who are studying with Kumu Patrick. Of those 350, most of those people are students, just students, mere mortals. 310 of the people. And so I am in one of the more advanced classes that he has, the junior class. There's also a senior class above me. And 40 or so of the people in the halau are in what we call the Sunday class or the performing group. So there's a professional company of dancers. They dedicate themselves very seriously to this. They practice 6 or 8 hours every Sunday, and they actually are the performers who perform annually on the stage in San Francisco, who travel to various cities and perform professionally. They're professional dancers.
Mm.
The rest of us are amateurs, and amateurs in the best sense of the word, you know, lovers of the craft that we are engaged in. And occasionally, Kumu Patrick will have a show that features some of us in the classes, and or it's very much part of Hawaiian culture that if you, yeah, you go out to hear some music, you're at a bar or a restaurant in Honolulu, and you love the music that they're playing, and you request a couple songs, and they realize that, gee, if you know that song, maybe you know how to dance, and then they'll invite you up to dance. And so it's very much part of our culture. Sort of spontaneous performance is very much part of Hawaiian culture. You dance at parties. You dance, as I said, you know, just when you're listening to music and you happen to know the song. There's kind of an expectation that if you know this song, you're supposed to dance to it. So I do perform, but I don't consider myself a professional performer, and I'm not in Kumu Patrick's professional company.
Well, since hula is the language of the heart, therefore, it is the heartbeat of the Hawaiian people. And to me, that's, you know, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and there's another one of, we talk about hula lineages. So when you're studying the hula, you have not only your teacher, but then your teacher's teacher and his or her teacher. So my hula great-grandmother, named Auntie Mikey IU Lake, and she was a really, really important figure in Hawaiian dance in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s. And as I mentioned earlier, she was part of this renaissance of Hawaiian culture. And Auntie Mikey's saying was that hula expresses, I'm probably going to get the quote wrong, but hula expresses everything we see, smell, feel, taste, hear. So it's hula is life, you know. So hula, when you study the hula and hula really becomes part of you, it allows you to express every emotion and every experience.
Now, is there any controversy about sort of opening hula up to heolis?
Yes, there is. I think, you know, not so much racial per se, because in Hawaii, you know, we have to remember that Hawaii is a very multiracial society, truly multiracial society. So we have Native Hawaiians, we have haoles or European and European people of European descent. We have a lot of Japanese, we have a lot of Chinese, we have a lot of Filipino, we have Samoans, we have we had an influx of Portuguese and Puerto Ricans in the late 1800s. They came to work in the sugar fields. And so there's a lot of intermarriage. So one thing about Hawaii is there are very few pure Hawaiians left. And so many people in Hawaii are of mixed race. And so it's been part of hula for a long time that hula embraces different races and you know, many hula dancers are mixed race themselves. So that's part of hula in a way. But there is a feeling that I think because hula was so close to being lost, there is a feeling of wanting to really protect it and keep the traditions and not water it down and not ruin it in a way. And so there is a feeling that if you study the hula, you ought to study the hula from people who are properly trained, and you need to learn not just certain movements and certain the movement vocabulary and the songs, but you need to learn the Hawaiian way of being and Hawaiian attitude. So it's a very kind of holistic approach to dance where you're not just learning dance moves, you're really learning a culture. You're learning how to understand another language, and you're learning how to embody certain values as well. So because that's so much part of the hula tradition, there is a lot of frustration when hula is taught outside of that context. So, for example, if you sign up for the hula class at your local gym and the person went to Hawaii for 2 weeks and learned a hula and is passing that hula on to you, that is frowned upon. And so I think, you know, the idea that someone, you know, there is a protection of hula. Kumu Patrick is kind of there's a different issue going on with him, where he is Native Hawaiian and he learned hula from one of the most respected cultural practitioners in the islands, but then he's stretching hula in new directions. And those are more, you know, he's using Broadway and Hollywood, and he's using music. I mean, Roberta Flack, he's choreographed pieces to Madonna, to Michael Jackson. And there are some in the hula world who think that that's dangerous, you know, I just use the word dangerous. That's kind of a pun, because one of the hulas that he does is to Michael Jackson's song, Dangerous. So he, you know, some people think he's playing with fire, and there's been some resistance, but I think he's overcome that by being very, very serious in his own hula, in his scholarship and in the work that he does. So there are definitely controversies.
Now, is the hit and run hula, is that one of his?
That's one of his innovations. Uh-huh. Yeah, the idea of hit and run hula, sort of flash mob hula. So the idea there was, what if we take hulas, some of them very traditional hulas, and we get a group of dancers, dozen dancers, and we put them on a bus, and then we let them get off the bus on the street corner in San Francisco and set up a boombox and start dancing the hula. And he actually got a grant from a local arts foundation, and he did this one summer, flash mob or hula or hit and run hula, they called it. And they performed Hula in the Streets. And the idea there was to take this really traditional dance and get it out of the stage, out of the theater, and just present it to people when they weren't expecting it. And maybe, you know, introduce them to hula or change their ideas about hula or just bring hula to a number of people who otherwise would not see it.
Now, is hula performed kind of around the world? And like, would a hula company go to Europe or go to South America or something to perform, or not yet?
It's performed. The answer is a qualified yes. So hula is performed a lot on the west coast of the United States. Hula has been performed at Wolf Trap. Hula has been performed at Carnegie Hall. Hula has been performed at the Smithsonian, and there's the Smithsonian Festival of American Folklife, where hula has been, because it is a, hula is an American folk art. You know, it is indigenous Americans. It's the authentic culture of a group of indigenous Americans. So it has made the big stage in that sense. It's been performed in New Orleans. Kumu Patrick gets invited to different shows and different festivals all over the country. Hula is huge in Japan, and so very many hula practitioners, hula teachers, take their groups to Japan, and it's hugely popular in Japan. And I'm sure that if someone came up with the funds to bring Kumu Patrick Mukuokane and 40 dancers to Salzburg, he would go. But I think it's probably hasn't been performed as much around the world. You know, I know it's been in Japan a lot, but it probably hasn't made it to Europe as much or to Latin America or other corners of the world.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Constance Hale, author of The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century. And it's a beautiful book about the history of hula and the modern hula. Before we, did you have some?
Well, I just was going to say, I can see why Japan would be interested in this. Their dance forms are very slow and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But similar to this, probably only in a slower.
In a sense, yeah. Yeah. I think they tell a story, too.
Yes, they do. Uh-huh.
Well, they're very stylized. Japanese dance is very stylized, as is hula. There's a lot of cross-pollination between Japan and Hawaii. I mean, you know, a lot of Japanese tourists visit Hawaii. It's a huge part of the Hawaii tourist industry because if you think about it, it's much closer to Japan than any part of the United States. So a lot of Japanese come to Hawaii and experience Hawaiian culture and take their love of it back to Japan. And then also there are very many Japanese in Hawaii because there was a huge amount of immigration from the Japanese mainland to Hawaii, and Japanese were brought to work in sugarcane fields. So there are a lot of Japanese Americans in Hawaii. So there's a pretty strong connection between Japan and Hawaii. There's also a strong connection between Hawaii and Mexico, which might seem weird, but Mexican cowboys were brought over to Hawaii in the 1850s to work on Hawaiian cattle ranches. And the Mexicans are actually the people who brought the guitar to Hawaii. So Hawaiian music owes a lot to Mexico and a lot to Spanish guitar. And there are a lot of hula schools and studios, for example, in Mexico City.
I never would have guessed.
No, I never would have. That's interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
So, Connie, how long did you work on this book?
I worked on it for, I did about a year's worth of research. I wasn't working on it full time, but over the course of a year, I tried to read everything I could about hula, and I did a number of interviews with different hula masters. It was kind of a cheat because I had done a lot of research in previous years to write the newsletter, so I've been writing about Kumu Patrick for very many years, so there was a lot of work that I'd already done. Mm. And then I wrote the book in about 6 months, probably, and then, of course, there were months and months of editing. One thing that might be interesting to your readers, and I know your show very much focuses on kind of inside the writing life, and, I'm sure some of your other guests have talked about, you know, the difficulty of bringing a book into the world, and not just the process of writing and bringing a book into the world, it's very hard, but the book industry. And so one challenge that I had as I mentioned, I had, for many years, I'd wanted to do a book about Hawaii, and I talked about different ideas with my agent, and I talked about different ideas with editors, and they never were particularly interested, and I think it's that Hawaii is really off the radar of the publishing, the center of publishing in New York. I mean, they just, people in the New York publishing world just aren't familiar with Hawaii or Hawaiian culture, Hawaiian history. And when I did the book proposal, so I wrote a book proposal for this book, as I do for all my books, I realized when I was writing the book proposal that I had a problem, and that was that I couldn't show what we call comps. I couldn't show any other books that had been published about Hawaiian culture, and certainly not about Hawaiian dance.
Wow.
That had sold. I couldn't show. There was nothing. The market,
wow.
There's been like two books published, one by St. Martin's, and, you know, one of the books was about Don Ho. You know, it doesn't get more cliched than that. And I went to my agent and I said, we have a problem. I can't find any comps. And there are some books about Hawaiian history, some good books. Sarah Vowell recently wrote Unfamiliar Fishes. So there are some books about Hawaiian history, but there are no books. I couldn't find any books about contemporary Hawaiian culture. And I realized it was going to be very hard to sell it to New York because there isn't, you know, there's not a place in the bookstore, a shelf on the bookstore that's labeled Hawaiian culture, or for that matter, even folk culture. It was really hard to find very many books.
Or even native culture.
A lot of books on ballet.
Wow.
You can find very few books on ethnic dance traditions. So that was sobering. And it was after writing the book proposal and having a long conversation with my agent that I decided to go kind of a different publishing route. And I went to Kumu Patrick and I said, I think we should produce this ourselves. And I think that, you know, we would get such a small advance, like maybe a museum publisher, an academic publisher would publish this book, but I had a different idea, and I also really wanted it to be a coffee table book. I wanted it to be larger in size, and we wanted it to have fabulous color photos. And most New York publishers are afraid of coffee table books because they're very expensive to produce and hard to market. So we made the decision at one point to go the indie route, you know, go to an independent publisher and have a lot more control over the book. And we, the arts organization was able to put up the funds for the making of the book and the printing of the book and hiring designers and editors and all those things. So for me, it was a departure creatively because all my books before this have been published by very respected. Well, my first book was published by Wired, which was kind of indie publishing. But, you know, my presumption is I would go to Random House or something, or Norton, one of my other publishers. So this was, the book took a lot more on the back end than books usually take because I was very involved in the editing, very involved in the page layout, cover design, printing. I was very involved in
it. You were it. It was all you.
And Kumu Patrick. So
Kumu Patrick.
That was both super fun and creative and interesting and also very time-consuming and exhausting and
Well, the result?
A reality, a dose of reality about how hard it is to actually get a book into publication, get it into the market.
Well, we have a beautiful result that we're holding in our hands. The natives are restless.
Yes,
San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century by Constant Hale. And Connie, we are out of time. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been such a delight to talk to both of you. I love the Mother-Daughter Act.
I can't wait
to share the URL for this with
I've got an outtake I've got an outtake that fits this perfectly. I've got to use it.
Okay.
I've used it before, but the goal in the game of life is to develop your talents and skills and then give them back to the world.
Thank you. Thank you, Connie. Thank you, Mom. See you next week on Writer's Voices.
You bet.
Mahalo.
Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.